Today's program has been brought to you by the Heritage Meat Shop, located in the historic Essex Street Market in New York City. For more information, visit heritagemeatshop.com. Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Greenhorn, this is Severin, it's Greenhorn Radio, and we are here in the summertime doing a lot of things, but mostly being happy about it being summer and eating tomatoes all the time. And we're joined today by Dan Phileas, who is in Michigan. He's a Michigander at the MSU Organic Farm. Hi, Dan, how you doing?
Doing well, Severin. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
So, those of us who are in farming world mostly know about MSU because of the Hoop House program that came from there.
Mm-hmm.
And is a lasting and national legacy of that program. But the majority of MSU is not about organic necessarily.
That's correct.
Although you're running the organic farm. Will you just give a little overview of the land grant and the farm and what goes on in Michigan?
So here we are, as far as I know, the only certified organic land that Michigan State University has at least in the East Lansing area. They may have, I don't think they do, but they may have certified organic land at some of the, they have different outposts around the state that are doing research on different fruits and vegetables, and they may have now some certified organic land, but we've been certified organic for, I believe, 7 years and are and have been a farm practicing organic agriculture for the last 11 years here on campus in East Lansing. MSU, I think, is the original land-grant university gifted land from the government to teach agriculture and to conduct agriculture research. And so we are also, we also have that mandate now to teach agriculture and to conduct agriculture research, but just with on certified organic land here.
So I was out there not that long ago because we're doing a collaboration with Future Farmers and the new Contemporary Art Museum, who are doing a project called Land Grant, just kind of celebrate and point to this, you know, historic status of MSU as a leader nationally and kind of champion some of the activities that have gone on. So that was very exciting to see the kind of contemporary art scene trying to wrap their head around, you know, what is the future of agriculture in America and how did the land grant play into that. How do you see that issue, and why did you choose to be involved at MSU? Why did you choose to go to MSU? Why did you choose to work at MSU?
Can you rephrase that question? Why I chose to come?
Why
to
are
MSU?
You there? What do you like?
Why
about?
Am I here? I'm here at MSU. Well, in a nutshell, I'm here at MSU because it was I was an assistant manager of a CSA in Wisconsin, and I wanted more responsibility and saw this opportunity online on one of the online job postings. And I was wanting to stay in the Midwest because my wife's family is from here. And I have a teaching background. I was a teacher for 5 years before I switched careers into agriculture. And so I wanted to be a teacher and a farmer at the same time. And here at the Student Organic Farm, where we are teaching new farmers and people who have never been farmers or farmers who have been farming but want to learn how to do so organically. I thought it would be a really unique opportunity to be here, and so was glad that I got the job.
Well, seems like you had your goals in order, and then you created a certain set of actions and precipitated actuality, and you like it. Sounds like you like it.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah, that event you were talking about out here, how it was held at the Barnes & Noble, the old, like, Barnes & Noble, like, moved out of that area, and then I loved the art,
Dan, are you there?
Hello? Yes? I was saying that, you know, that event that you came out here for, I remember a couple months back, there was, I loved the marketing for it, where it was held in an old Barnes & Noble, and they had moved out, but the marketing, like, put up all in, on brown paper in the windows, they said, Barnes are Noble, and I just loved that.
Barnes are Noble, and you guys have great barns in Michigan, beautiful barns, and beautiful soil, and lots of water.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit on the Michigan agricultural economy. Tell us. Sometimes people get all bottlenecked up and they want to live in the Northeast, or they think they have to be near a city or whatever. They
mm-hmm.
they start getting all enclosed. And when I came up to Michigan, I was impressed. I thought, wow, we got to get some more people out here. This place is awesome. So
yeah,
give us
you
a
know,
little
it's really, I was surprised when I came here that at how much agriculture there is here. And it's the second most diverse as far as, like, number of crops grown in the state. It's second only to California in number of crops grown. So there's, like, all the west side of the state along Lake Michigan is, like, blueberries, cherries, all sorts of different of different fruits. There's a thriving wine grape growing industry up in the up near Traverse City, up also where there's cherries up there. It's got there's a revitalized hops growing industry up there too, and but over in the thumb, you know, because it's shaped like a mitten, we call it the thumb over there. That thumb area, they grow all sorts of dry beans and grains. And then in the center of the state, it's all sorts of different things. There's vegetable farms here and there. There's like corn and soybeans like you would see in maybe elsewhere in the Midwest. But there's just all sorts of different crops being grown here. There's also a thriving like beer brewing industry and some great beers and brewers that are really focused on using local ingredients and crafting some really tasty brews. So I think it's a really terrific place to live. And
so there's a lot going on, and people who are interested in especially horticultural crops,
yeah,
are many of them going to MSU for training?
Yeah,
tell us about the program that you're running and kind of who's in it and where are they oriented and how is Michigan kind of pointing towards the future?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we run a 9-month intensive training program called the Organic Farmer Training Program, as it were, and we. It's unique in that it teaches year-round organic farming, and it is so. As you were saying earlier, we have sort of made our name as being hoop house growers here at the student organic farm, and so we have a 48-week CSA that our students are involved in running, a 7-month-long farm stand that they also run, and they each manage one of these in the program. When they come in here, they are manage one of the hoop houses and one of the fields. So they get experience growing in the traditional season out in the fields, but then they also get experience planning for and growing crops in the hoop houses that we have here. So they're growing, you know, kale year-round and salad greens that we sell to the university for sale, or that they put out of the salad bar in the dining halls. We grow those year-round, and the students in the program are learning that. It's also a cool program.
So that's a unique training because they don't do that in Santa Cruz, number one.
Right.
Number
exactly,
two, it prepares students to leave Michigan and go places like Vermont where they, mm-hmm. you know, if they don't know how to grow under plastic, then they're going to be twiddling their thumbs for kind of a lot of the year.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a really, you know, that's pretty much, it seems, I mean, from where we stand at least, it seems like that's where the future is going. Like, people are getting hoop houses, and at one point it was like, well, you know, grow tomatoes in this hoop house because you'll get ahead of the you know, the other market, the other farmers at the markets, and you'll be able to sell tomatoes earlier and at a higher price. But now, you know, more and more, farmers, that has now become standard. There are early tomatoes. There are early other things. You have to really grow some. You have to really think about how to market things really well and grow some unique things in order to.
Well, and when we had this terrible problem 2 seasons ago in the Northeast with late blight, a lot of farmers, experienced $30,000, $50,000 worth of crop loss.
Yeah.
And that precipitated investment in greenhouses just to have a little bit more assurance, I guess, you know, you never know what's going to really happen. Some tornadoes could come.
Right, right.
But, right. You know, the hoop house provides a bit of a guarantee against Mother Nature and her changing ways.
It gives you that climate control a little bit. Yep, definitely. In addition to the early... the early production and late production, and what am I saying? It's year-round production. We're harvesting greens, you know, in January for sale to the dining halls here. So
tag a resource, since we're talking about year-round vegetable growing, for those of you who are thinking about year-round vegetable growing and don't already know about Elliot Coleman's four-season growing and the use of multiple layers of cover, so you think, oh, this doesn't work. This won't work because I'm in Canada, or I'm in northern New York, or I'm in Vermont. You're not. There's enough plastic products out there to insulate.
you too can be saved by plastic.
You too. Yeah. There's a farmer here in the valley, and he talked about this idea he had of distilling all the plastic that he used on his farm and then turning it back into oil so that he could run his tractors on it.
Yeah.
Not too bad of an idea. So there is this plastic problem, but let's talk about the positive sides of season extension from a food security perspective.
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, that's a big criticism maybe of, like, it has been a big criticism of, like, the local foods system, like, where are people going to get the local food in the seasons when we can't grow local food? Well, if you can have a more robust local economy and a farm economy, just like our budget is shored up, you know, by being able to sell year round. We are able to have that constant influx. We have three CSA sessions throughout the year that match up with the semesters here, 16 weeks each. But we, you know, rather than having that one big influx of CSA cash at the beginning of the traditional growing season, we've got 3 points throughout the year where we get the influx of cash, and it's a really nice way to keep the bills paid throughout the year here. And even though we're at the university, sorry, continue.
No, you go ahead. I'm sorry, you're the interviewee.
What I was going to say was that even though we're at the university here, our operational budget, we receive no outside funding, so our operational budget is paid for by the produce that we sell, and so it's really nice for students who come here to learn how to be organic farmers to see that side of the business that we can sustain ourselves through the vegetable sales that we have here. And so that's an increasing part of the program that we've really strengthened in recent years is the business planning side of things.
Wow, that's amazing. That's a very good model to force the program to be. I think they should force other things like, no, we won't get into the politics, but
sure.
That's an honest training, and I wish I saw it in all farmer training operations, that kind of business transparency.
Well, I'm glad you think so.
So we're talking about resilient farm economy and local food security. When you have cash inflow coming into the farm all year round, would you agree or would you argue with this statement that as we're looking at creating a more sustainable farm economy, more sustainable farming practices, and kind of more regionalized food production, that the farm sector is going to need to have a more resiliency, and that right now a lot of farmers are struggling with debt, are struggling with drought, and that there isn't that much like kind of breathing space, or there isn't enough breathing space to give farmers opportunity to invest in practices that will make their land more drought resistant, practices to diversify their output so they can not rely so much only on kind of commodity prices, that sometimes these tools like this greenhouse, this hoop house tool is like a tool that can make other tools possible because of increasing profitability?
I think I would agree with that, yes. I think I would agree with that, I generally agree with the sentiment that anything that you, any tool that you can use that gets you a little bit ahead in either work or in cash flow will allow for will allow for easier times or more flexibility down the road. And so, like an example, like on the farm here, we got a tine weeder this year, implement for our tractor, and we were able to tine weed several more beds than we had in the past, which eliminated like hand weeding from some of our onions. Which that time that you know hand weeding onions can be such a time suck on a farm, on an organic farm that is, and so by investing in that implement, paying the money that we would have paid people to weed it, and buying an implement with it instead, it allowed us to just go through, weed that really quick, and gave us the flexibility then with the time that we saved to have the people do other things on the farm. And we've, I think, been more ahead in general on weeds on the farm, more so than just three beds worth that we, you know, that we tilled or tine weeded with our tine weeder. It really magnified. And so any tool. So that's an analogy, I guess. I agree with you. Hoop houses can afford for more flexibility.
Yeah. So these are the kinds of tools, practices, and especially creating kind of low cost technologies and kind of suggested farm practices that really make mm-hmm. sense as in the toolkit used mm-hmm. by farmers, not only at the university farm, but hopefully building on the model of extension. Extending the access to that innovation and thoughtful development of technologies out to the network of all the farmers in the state for the benefit sure. of the region as a whole.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And we want our farmers who are farmers who we're training in our program. We want them. We're preparing them to be farmers. You know, from right out the gate. So we want. It's really inspiring to see. The farmers who were in this program now in their farms around the state and starting businesses of their own and having success and sort of expanding that network and demonstrating what we have been doing here but just as in little satellite locations. They're not doing training programs of their own but just putting into practice what we're trying to teach, and it's not necessarily the extension thing, but it's a seed that gets planted in local communities around the state where different communities can see what year-round growing is like and be inspired by that, I think.
And across the country, frankly.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's not just a state, you're right.
Again, just to tag another resource, so this, well, I think that she had your exact job. Did Corey have your exact job?
Oh, Corey was who was at Sterling College?
Yeah.
Yep. She was the she helped actually start the organic farmer training program, and things have been restructured here since. But like she left right before I arrived, and they did some restructuring, so there was some overlap between what she did and what I do. But she was more on the educational side of things, like managing the training program, while I am managing production. There is another couple people who are more 100% involved in the training program side of things, and I'm more 100% involved in the actual growing of the crops here.
That sounds good. Well, so regardless of the overlap, so Corey was there, and mm-hmm. she left to go start her own farm in Vermont. Well, first she did like a little stint at Sterling, but then she started her own farm, bread and butter farm in Vermont. And again, mm-hmm. just to tag a resource, the UVM Community Finance PDF that is available through the UVM Beginning Farmer Training Program website cites Corey's farm as a case study. And she, unfortunately, she built a hoop house on her farm to do wintergreens. Like a good Michigander, and then the horrible snowstorm in March 2010, 11, was really late after a lot of other snow, and it was really wet, and it destroyed her hoop house. Yeah. And so then the next season, this is all from the case study, I'm just giving you a little play-by-play. The next season, the co-op down the road said, hey, Corey, we love your kale, we love your winter greens, we want more, and Corey said, That's great. We're glad you love our greens, but we can't grow any more because our hoop house is destroyed. So only way you could get more is if I can raise $15,000 to build another hoop house. And they said, oh, that's so sad. And then 5 minutes later, they called her back and they said, well, we'd like to buy you another hoop house.
Wow.
And so that's another, just an example of how, you know, these are interlocking problems and solutions that you know, when you set up an expectation for winter production, then you might just build yourself a market that's willing to pony up to invest further to expand that market.
Yeah.
And that what we have today, the kind of matrix of possibilities and marketplaces that exist currently, is only what we have currently, and there is tremendous potential just beyond the horizon.
Yeah.
Maybe that was a little over optimistic. So what's kind of happening recently with the weather in your state? Or, you know, you guys have Debbie Stabenow in your state, who's been chair of the Farm Bill. I mean, give us a little bit of news from Michigan, if you don't mind.
Well, unfortunately, I feel grossly out of touch with the Farm Bill, and so I can't comment on that. I can comment on the weather that I'm deeply connected with. We've been subject to the drought that has been hitting lots of different places, and so you know we've had the last few weeks, I guess, we've had some reprieve from that, but there was, you know, a couple months where we got just, you know, 0.03 inches here, 0.01 inches there, total of about an inch and a half over 2 months, and we've only had a quarter inch in the last couple weeks, and we do have to irrigate a lot this year. But it's been warm, and aside from that, you know, the lack of water, thankfully we do have a fairly good irrigation system here on the farm, and we've been able to subsidize the groundwater with our irrigation water, and the warmth that has been just really hot this year, and the crops are loving it. So as long as we can keep the wetness up there, the crops have been responding. So that's
good. So that's good for vegetable farmers to have good irrigation.
But if you
those
don't have
around
good irrigation,
you.
Yeah, it has been just trials and tribulations this whole year. It's been that's just this time of year. Earlier, you know, I was saying it's a very diverse state. There's the entire fruit industry, except for maybe blueberries, lost nearly 100% of their crops this year because of the early warmth that we had, which broke the dormancy of these fruit crop flower buds, and those flowers bloomed early, and then we got, you know, we didn't get a late freeze, but we just got a normal freeze as it's supposed to happen, and that took out all the flower buds, and there was, you know, in some places 97% fruit loss. It's just not a really devastating hit for the fruit crops in Michigan this year, but blueberries, I guess, fruit later or flower later, and we're not damaged by that. So there's great blueberry crops still coming out.
Well, so this is the thing also that I mean, from a Farm Bill perspective, I just got an alert, e-blast alert, you know, from National Wildlife Federation talking about how the drought payments that are being made, like there's been all this kind of emergency drought.
Sure.
Credit being issued and
yep.
kind of support being offered from the USDA, but that basically the wildlife or conservation lobby was screaming because that money is coming right out of the conservation budget. So, you know, as good organic farmers, we know that adding organic matter to your soil is one of the best assurance methods other than an expensive irrigation system for maintaining soil moisture. Organic production, particularly in drought years, will outperform conventional production. So, but instead of investing strategically in these, you know, the kinds of practices that would make our agricultural systems kind of more agroecologically resilient to extreme weather, we are like slicing at our good practices budget to just bail out.
Right.
And you know, it's not an us or them situation, and it's not a like. one or the other, and it's really unfortunate when it gets, when it becomes like a vicious duality like that.
Yeah, yeah. It's very
true. I don't know, there's not an easy answer, but it's definitely the kind of causal relationship between those, the practices that, like, compact the soil are the practices that also make farming and farmers more vulnerable to adverse weather conditions.
Right, right. You know, it's interesting. We're seeing you mentioned water saving organic matter, and that just we grow our potatoes. We like to do things a lot of different ways out here to demonstrate it for the students. And so we have half of our, well, not half, but some of our potatoes are grown under mulch rather than being hilled, and then we have right next to them ones that are being hilled. And there's this stark contrast between the mulched ones and the hilled ones. The mulched ones, you know, mulch conserves water, and so it stayed moister underneath that mulch, and the plants are just vibrant and green as all get out. And then next to that, in these hilled potatoes, and, you know, tillage, or hilling, which is a type of tillage, will release water from the soil. So when we hilled, we set our potatoes back, I think, because those hilled ones, they're crispy and brown. They are definitely not as strong looking. And it's within, you know, there's two beds side by side, like, that are the same variety, one mulched, one hilled, and it's not a varietal difference. It's definitely mulch versus hilled. And so that definitely adding organic matter in many ways, including that, is so helpful in years like this.
So if anyone's listening who's in charge of the mandate that are deciding research agendas for the land-based universities, it sounds like there's interest in considering research around which are the more weather-resilient agricultural practices.
Yeah.
That's something that I definitely would like to see more of, just to talk about it in those terms
right.
Would be amazing.
Yeah.
Did you know, Dan, that we're coming to Michigan to do a farm hack?
No, I didn't. Oh, wait. Yes, I did. I didn't realize, though, that it was a roving group of farm hackers that came and hacked farms around the place, or around the country. But I had seen that there was a farm hack event going to be happening in Detroit or Ann Arbor or something. Can you say
Detroit
and
Ann Arbor? But maybe we need to do a third leg in East Lansing.
We would love to host Farm Hack. You know, it's something that I think is such a great initiative that's out there for young farmers to. You know, I don't know. Seeing all the creativity that goes into the things that are put on Farm Hack, it really inspires me.
Okay, well, it sounds like we have to have a conversation off air about that, and I will CC you into the planning doc.
Sounds good.
But regardless, it's really wonderful to connect. And just in our last little moment here, I wanted to make sure that I ask you to tag any kind of rare and unusual resources that people might not have come across yet that you know, are your faves or organizations or things going on.
Man, oh, gosh. My
favorite. Oh, gosh.
I know. Oh, my goodness. I'm not prepared for this.
Okay, you don't have to. It's okay. There's a lot out there.
There's a lot out there. This is like, you want to know, how much more time do I have to think about this?
I think, like, let's see. Oh, you don't have very much time. You only have...
25 seconds.
You only have a minute.
A minute to think of a couple of some odd or maybe unconventional resource that might help out farmers out there?
Yeah, and add to our encyclopedic database of young farmer resources.
You know, I can only say that I really I've grown a lot in going to conferences, taking the time to go to conferences. So I really learned. I think the best conferences out there that I've been to were the NOFA conference in Massachusetts and the Moses conference out here in Wisconsin. And if anybody can take the time to go to those conferences, those are really great. If those people in Michigan, the Northern Michigan Small Farms Conference has been really great. And this year there's the Michigan Organic Food and Farming Association is having a conference in Flint, and that's great. Also, I think it's going to be a terrific one.
Yeah, and you know, these conferences are many of them looking for to include young organizers also.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and to keep this tradition strong, like many of them were founded by what were then hippies, young hippies, who are now not necessarily still hippies, but many of them older. And so the continuity of that amazing resource is also within our mandate as a movement to keep it strong. And the other thing to say is a lot of these conferences are offering scholarships for beginning farmers because of this nice beginning farmer and rancher development project that have gotten, you know, some grant money flowing around beginning farmer projects. So I know Moses, for instance, had a whole beginning farmer track and a lot of beginning farmer programming, and we're supporting beginning farmers to attend because it can be kind of costly, all the hotel business.
Yeah, and the thing, those conferences I mentioned, the thing I like most about those conferences in particular is that they're pretty much by farmers and for farmers. So it's one thing to hear about work done by universities and extension and things like that, but there's also, I get a lot out of hearing other farmers and just hearing their experiences that they've had and say, hey, this works for me. You might want to try it. So I really like that.
Here, here. So thank you so much, Dan, and see you in Michigan soon. I'll email you right now, so don't forget.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much, Severin. It was good to talk to you.
All the best. Bye-bye. Bye-bye, everyone. Oh,
bye.
This has been another episode of Greenhorns Radio for Young Farmers, by Young Farmers. There's a lot coming up in September in terms of events, so I need you to be sure and check the mailing list, which is going to be blasted out tomorrow, and check our events page. We've got Seed Camp in Maine, a Beef Out event, of eating beef outside here in the Hudson Valley. We have Farm Hacks in New York City, Farm Hack in Ithaca, New York. There's just a lot. So what's my point? Thank you for being part of the network, and please use this little bit of a reprieve from the heat to eat lots of tomatoes and start planning your schedule for the harvest season, your harvest parties, your harvest organizing, whatever it's going to be, because September promises to be very, very busy. Okie dokie. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.